Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, her latest novel is Fane. Anne-Marie MacDonald joins me in studio. This is my first in-studio interview in about 2.5 years, so welcome.
Thank you.
We've been doing them by Zoom for quite some time.
How does it feel to be?
It's a little weird looking across from someone rather than staring at my screen, that's for sure.
I know. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Initially, this book was going to come out a year ago, and then I got quite ill, and I got better. But it kind of delayed everything by a year, and now I'm going to, thank goodness, I get to actually go places and be in real rooms with real people like you.
That has to be, I mean, I suppose it's one of those things where some authors maybe really cherish that, and some people maybe are fearful of it, right? Like, some authors, to them, it's like the solitary work and the inner room inventing worlds is the thing, and some it's like sharing that with the world is the thing, in the same way that like some bands love the studio and some bands love the road.
Yeah, I love them both. I mean, I have the required stamina to spend very long periods of time by myself in the worlds that I'm creating. There's no question about that. But I have this whole other side, a whole other skill set from my very first career as an actor, right?
Uh-huh.
I went to National Theater School. I trained as an actor. I still act from time to time. I'm a playwright. So I do crave live, in-person collaboration, while at the same time I do have a kind of camel-like capacity to go for long distances without it. But I'm really grateful to be on the road and going to actual places, meeting actual readers and talking to actual people in an actual studio. I'm so tired of Zoom.
Yeah. So speaking of that camel-like quality, I have to imagine the genesis of this record, this book.
You can call it a record.
This book, rather. This is the thing, because I do talk to bands.
That's good.
Required Saharan-level retention and sustainability of your own self, right? Like, because this is a massive book, but I have to imagine in building out this world, there was a lot that went on before pen on paper or like hand on keyboard in terms of either research or like investigating kind of like language and place and how you would kind of bring this to life.
Yes. And thank you for acknowledging my dromedary-like capacity. The Sahara, I think it's the Sahara caliber capacity. It's true, I immerse myself in the worlds and in the research domains that my worlds are going to be drawing on. And I love that. I absolutely love that part. But I don't do it all ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
I start with an image which compels me and makes me feel like there's the heart beating right there. There's something in that picture. I actually draw a picture. This is something I've always done with all my work. And I'd like to say that if you could see all these drawings, you would know why I did not choose to follow a visual arts path. But they are like messages to me from my unconscious. And they say, this is what wants to come out into the world. And then I investigate that image. I go, who is this person? Where is that landscape? When are we? What are the clues in this picture? And that's where I know it's alive. I know it's alive, and I got to find out. And in this case, it took me the late 19th century to this 12,000-acre moorland estate that straddles the border between Scotland and England.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a good deal about all the delicious tropes of a Victorian novel, you know, crumbling mansion, family secrets, quest for identity, all of those things. I love those devices. I love the language. So that to me is just like being in a toy box or in a trunk full of dress-ups that I get to play with. There's also a great deal about the history of medicine, especially when women and non-gender conforming and queer and physically different, or should say just slightly out of the ordinary people, are caught in the medical gaze. The history of that medical gaze absolutely fascinates me, as well as domains of science and the development of technology, and when does magic become science and when does science become magic again? And all through all of this, the earth is really a character, and I mean literally the mud that's under our feet. What's that telling us?
Mm-hmm. So was it a picture of Fane, like of the land, the moor, or what was the image that you investigated and drew this story out from?
Well, first off, it was a landscape, and it's a rippling landscape, as if, you know, the turbulent surface of the North Atlantic had been stilled by the wave of a wand, and it becomes solid, and it's land. Okay, so I'm on moorland. I know what that looks like. But it really does look like it might just turn back into waves at any moment. So is it liquid or is it solid? And there's a clue in that, because Earth is always changing, always transforming, right? One thing is always becoming another. And that fascinates me too. Certainly, you know, metaphorically, liminal spaces, but also just in nature. Nature loves the margins. Nature burgeons where there aren't straight lines and edges. So that fascinated me too, because I thought, I'm in a blurred, creative, burgeoning environment. It's mysterious. And there's a young person in the corner of this picture. I'm not sure what their gender is, but I know they're very young. They're in late 19th century, kind of romantic garb on the masculine side, but I know they're not necessarily male or female. On the horizon in the distance is the silhouette of a crumbling mansion. So I go, I know I'm in Bronte country. I'm in Gothic country, and I know there's secrets here. And I wrote this caption. This caption came to me, and it's the words that are being spoken by that hopeful young person. And they're saying, I had heard something out on the fen. Mm. So I thought, okay, I got to find out what did they hear? Who are they?
So you mentioned loving the language, the Victorian era language. Is that as a reader, or is that someone who creates that language yourself? Like what? Yeah, it attracts you to it.
It's both. It's both. When I was like, 10 years old, one of my older sisters handed me Jane Eyre and said, here, read this. And I did. I devoured it. And I read it many times as I was growing up and into my adulthood. And with the best books, of course, you get something different out of it every time. But it's not like I had the vocabulary to be reading that 19th century classic, but it completely drew me in. And it's almost like the words, the language, I kind of knew what color and texture they were. They brought me into a world that became immersive and very vibrant, whether I knew exactly what they meant or not. And then I would actually start to feel like I actually got a kick out of the fact that there were these long, complicated words, which really meant something really pretty simple. And I thought, is that really how they spoke back then? Or is that their way of putting a fancy tablecloth to hide the table legs because there's actually something seething under the surface of those words? And with Jane Eyre and with that Gothic literary fiction, there really is. There's so much visceral, messy stuff going on that every now and then you need a word that is the equivalent of a very polite-looking doily. I was also a big Bugs Bunny fan as well. So I'm always being struck by the humor or the irony, right? Mm. And so for me, those were the Brontes, Bugs Bunny, and the Beatles were my, I could triangulate my entire growing up and creative evolution within those 3 points.
So then with regards to Jane Eyre, you side with Gwendolyn Haas, the character who likes the book, rather than Charlotte Bell, the character who kind of dismisses it after reading.
Yeah, Charlotte is our main, is our real protagonist. She's celebrating her 12th birthday at the opening of the book, and she's never had a girlfriend. She has an audiographic, photographic memory. She's like an incredibly smart kid who wants only to go to school, but is confined to their 12,000-acre estate because of her mysterious condition. So when she finally gets a girlfriend, it's like, what? Wow, what is this? And Gwen basically teaches her to have a sense of humor and to know actually kind of how funny she is and to be able to laugh at herself.
And what life is like outside of fame.
I know that you're now like in possession of all kinds of cutting edge scientific and technological information, but have you ever tasted cocoa?
Mm.
Have you ever been to a party? I don't think so. Have you ever stayed up all night laughing? I don't think so.
Yeah, it's obviously this is a child who's been kept in the dark about a lot of things. But by virtue of, the motley crew of people that are on this estate has a very particular view of the world, right? The father's already an odd duck and made more so by what happens within the story. A very intelligent person. In the book smarts sense, but maybe not in the emotional intelligence sense. And then Baron is the knowledge keeper of the Fen.
Oh, Byrne. Yeah.
Sorry, this is me trying to pronounce it after reading it and only hearing it in my head.
Yeah, old Byrne, yeah.
That it's a very like prismatic view of the world, and that becomes more of a kaleidoscopic view of the world as the story unfolds.
That's a nice way of putting it, yeah.
Curious in terms of the way the book is laid out, because you start from Charlotte's perspective. It's told from, you know, first person, like it's her story. She's like relating to the reader, and then you back the train up and switch sections, and then, you know, sort of tell what led her to being on Fane, a story through her mother's experiences, but not told through any one particular person's perspective. And then you kind of back and forth mm-hmm. throughout the book the rest of this way. Did you consider telling other stories from someone else's perspective, or did it just need to be outside of everyone?
That's part of the evolution for me. That was part of the evolution in the process of writing this book, was really, really finding out whose voice is and what perspective it needed to be from, right? And when to make those switches. And for example, Charlotte is telling the story in first person narration, but it's all in past tense. Mm. I was here, this happened, they did that, right? But then when we go to the past, we're in the present tense. And when I came to understand that, when I came to make that choice, it made a lot of sense, because I thought, okay, Charlotte has the youthful, immediate, this is happening now voice, but it's in the past tense. It's it's I did this, this happened, etc., right? But with this very immediate feeling. Whereas when we go into the past, it's Lord Henry does such and such. His new wife-to-be is this and that, right? It's all in the present tense. Okay, I'm really geeking out on this stuff. This is stuff that really fascinates me. Because, of course, put the past in the present and the present in the past. And that is going to really enliven and keep the narrative really alive for the reader, especially when you change perspective. That's a bold thing to do in a book, when you're taking the reader along and you've got this big story and you're coming to these critical points and you go, okay, well, actually now we're going to go to the past and you're going to find out something about how we got here. Just when you have that forward momentum, so it's bold, it's a daring thing to do, and you got to make it worth the reader's while, right? So there's that switch of narrator, there's a switch of tense, it's sort of like, what? Oh, okay, here we are. So that was something that I found very exciting when I settled on that. And also there's so many secrets in the book that I had to work very long and very organically, and you know, behind me is a kind of a mountain of mind tailings, is how I think of it, the number of pages which it took to actually get this story told, right? Mm. I have to explore so much before I know, okay, this character knows this part of the story. This person thinks they know the whole thing, but they don't know the whole thing. And at intervals, I would literally resort to recipe cards on the floor and just trying to keep it straight for myself, because I had a kind of a gullibility which I cultivated, which is important to me. It's a kind of gullibility that I need to be able to come with fresh eyes to the story I'm working on, so I can see it through the reader's eyes. Mm. But that gullibility kind of cuts both ways, because I was repeatedly tricked by the characters. And I would have to go, no, wait, remember, they're lying about that. That's not what happened then, or that's not when that happened. That's their story, or that's what they believe because they've been told by someone else. So I got drawn in myself. So I thought, well, that's a good thing, but I do have to keep the story straight after all and guide the reader through it.
Right. But attempting to do so in a way that you're not as kind of the like macro brain person, signaling too much micro.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, like I'm rock climbing or I'm climbing a mountain and I'm going to blaze a trail and put in some spikes for handholds and ropes and stuff, right? But I've gone up other faces of that mountain. I've taken different routes up and I've gone way back down to base camp. Mm-hmm. And I finally go, okay, here's where I'm going to put a spike in here. I'm going to put a guide wire here. And this is how the reader is going to make this ascent and these discoveries.
So then at what point did you hit upon the, like, this is exactly where I'm going to stop Charlotte's story, part one, turn the page and suddenly we're back, you know, 15 years. when did that idea germinate, and how did that kind of like sort itself out? Like, well, did you already have some of like a forward momentum and have to kind of like back the train up a little?
Well, I remember the moment. Well, here's the thing too, is that I'll start working on a story and I'll accumulate more and more and more. Then I'll realize, okay, there are tracts of it. There are narrative tracts, right? It's like, imagine a great big painting and you start to fill in one corner of it, and that tells you about what should be in the opposite corner. So you go back to that corner and you're just kind of painting and then altering and making it all into one thing, depending on what you learn in all these other quadrants. And that's what it's like for me. So that I already had a whole bunch of the plot, and I thought, when do we get to this? And I know this is going to be third-person narration in the present tense, but when? And I do remember it was probably like 2.5 years ago, and it was a great day because I just went, right, it's now. And Charlotte is going to pull up to this front door, and it's going to open, and the reader's going to turn the page, and they're going to be behind that door, which is opening, and it's going to be someone else who walks through that door. So I realized, oh, right, that's how. And that repeats, right? Mm-hmm. We go up to a door, and that also is that's a storytelling device, right? We go, this has happened before in a different way, but our protagonist does not know it. This is a repetition, and that becomes a kind of a haunting, right? So that the reader is, I mean, there should be that jolt, and at the same time, a kind of sense of, oh, of course, of course. I also worked really hard this time to create a kind of immersive experience for the reader of the kind that I like to have. And I wanted to have the feeling of like being lost in a miniseries, right? Because that I love that. And I want to do something like that. So that means that I want to craft it very carefully. And every now and then, go, okay, we're going to now, we're cutting to a whole different moment. And it's like I can see the shot list right in my head,
right?
And I work really hard to create a world in which the reader can forget that anyone wrote this, and that it's even a book. That's my goal.
I'm so immersed in it that you're not seeing kind of the authorial hand.
Exactly, and then you're not caring about how anyone did this. You're just caring that you're following it. You're in it with these people, and they start to maybe belong to you. That's at least I hope, right? And you forget about whoever wrote it.
Interesting that was your intent, because very often I found myself saying, like, if someone would just tell the truth, right? Like, that so much hinges on either, like, misunderstanding or concealment, where it's like, if you just tell the other person.
Yeah, just come
the
clean.
The truth, and I was getting frustrated at the characters, like being like, just do the thing, like do the work, and forgetting that obviously, like, this is a completely fabricated scenario, and these people you've told them to do.
Well, and they're, you know, they've all got their very good reasons, usually for the sake of somebody else's well-being, you know, the road to hell and all that.
You mentioned, you know, your background in acting and theater. Do you think about the way the bodies move in your stories?
Always. That's foundational.
I was just curious because Lord Henry, Charlotte's father, very often is looking at Charlotte sidelong, it seems. Like, he's really, like, his attention is focused on something else and kind of, like, acknowledging her but not, like, fully looking at her. And it seemed to be a recurrent thing throughout the story. And how intentional not really seeing her was.
Very, very much so. Evasiveness is built right into the fabric of how he moves. And how he inhabits his body and the world. And that's developed over time, such that it feels, I'm sure it would feel to him as if it were inevitable and everybody's like that. But it is something that he has developed as a way of coping with the circumstances of what life has dealt him and of the choices that he has made and critically not made. So that, yes, he is always a little bit unavailable, especially to the people whom he loves more than anything.
You do get into his head and his thinking at times, and he does legitimately care for and love Charlotte, but the way he treats her suggests otherwise.
I don't know. Like, does it?
I think at times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
exactly, right? Because you go, if that's love, but exactly, right? So it's like he is adhering to a wisdom which is not his own in doing what he believes must be best for his daughter, but he's not really listening to his inner truth. I think there's no question about that. But nor is he willing to relinquish the power that he has.
Nor is he fully listening to her, right? Like when she says she wants to go to university, it's like, yeah, like he yada yadas it, right? Like that it's mm-hmm. like you'll it's a phase. You'll stop.
And also maybe who knows? Maybe by the time it comes around, then it might be possible. Who knows, right? So he can tell himself that it's perhaps just a question of time, right?
Yeah.
So that's another way of very nice but self-exculpatory people just putting things off until it's way too late. And you go, dude, that was a crime of omission. Crimes of omission have consequences which can be as catastrophic as crimes of commission.
Yeah, that notion of like crimes, it makes me think of, so villainy, you know, there's...
That's a good word.
There's villainy of like intention and then there's like villainy of action, right? And I was curious about like whether you see any of the characters as villains straight up or if the things they do are villainous.
Well, I think that, you know, for example, there is in True Victoria, there is in True Victorian style a spinster aunt with a spine of steel, and that is Lord Henry's older sister. And she is committed to the continuance of the title above and beyond all else. And of course, in a world where she had inherited, she wouldn't have to have gone to the lengths that she did. And Henry himself regrets that his sister couldn't have inherited rather than him because he would have had a nicer life too. But does he step aside? No, no. So there's an example of a character who ultimately is ruthless and yes, ultimately does villainous things. And it's almost like she's the one who's got the nerve to do the dirty work on behalf of the guy over here who needs to keep his hands lily white, the lovely, gentle Lord Henry, whom everyone loves. Okay, I guess it's down to me. Go ahead, everyone can hate me while I do the thing that's going to preserve him.
Less preserve him than preserve the title, right? Like that's...
Yeah, exactly. Preserve the title. Much as she loves him, the title is more important. And of course, she made a promise to her own late father, Daddy, Papa, I promise you, I will see Fane continue. I will take it on. So, yeah, she's also another daughter in thrall to her father and to the patriarchy.
The choice of calling the book Fane.
Ah.
Like, did you consider other titles? Or is this because that centrality of that property in this, like, title and the fact that things can evaporate if, you know, it's contested or if there's no male heir? That, like, yes, it's been around for centuries, but it's a fraught place psychologically and territorially.
Yes, yeah. I never entertained any other titles. And... Fane is my creation, the estate, that part of the world is, you know, something that I made up. And somebody asked me if it was real. I said, I made it up. Yes, of course, it's real. And for me, that's actually true. It's not just a coy answer. But Fane, F-A-Y-N-E, is the name of the estate. And I just loved how many other words were in there with different spellings, meaning different things, not least of which is the origin of fae and fairy, right? And... the real kind of old wisdom and old pagan regard and respect for the earth is invoked by the name, as well as Fen, as well as, you know, all the other spellings of Fane mm-hmm. and their meanings.
So it, like, when you saw that picture that you drew.
Yeah.
Did you name the place Fane, basically?
Oh, I wish I knew when that arose, because it's one of those things that I can't remember it not having been called Fane, and yet... I made it up. So there had to have been a day early on when I thought, that's the name of this place. It makes me want to go back into the some earlier manuscripts and find out when that started. Because no, when I drew the picture, I didn't know what it was called.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think I experimented with different names, you know. I loved, there's a place in the Northwest Highlands called Cape Wraith. And sometimes called,
yeah. W-R-A-I-T-H?
Yeah, I love that. And some people call it Cape Wrath. And then there are other Gothic names, and I was toying with all of that. And then that one came to me, and I don't know why or when. So it was probably a gift.
Right.
Yeah.
Apart from the novels that, you know, like Jane Eyre pulled from, you know, that era, like, I mean, this is set in the, like, 1870s, 1880s. Did you find, like, primary sources of, like, medical textbooks, of, you know, land maintenance, like things like that, because there's a variety of things that happen within this book that I'm curious about, kind of like the, like, are you trying to write as if the person is only knowing what they know up to that point and not you looking back on, you know, historical recounting of, you know, what a Scottish farm would be like in 1870?
I spent a lot of time with original sources. I love that. I went to museums of the history of medicine in Glasgow, in Scotland. I went to museums of the history of medicine in Edinburgh and Glasgow. I spent a few months at the Osler Library of the History of Medicine at McGill University. Mm. So with original original documents, catalogs of surgical equipment and appliances, reports from insane asylums, doctors' reports, charts, all kinds of things, and also just the artifacts, the surgical artifacts, and all the hundreds of jars of formaldehyde preserved organic specimens of pieces of people, bits of folk, as they say in the book. Whatever it says about me, I fully admit I cannot get enough of this stuff. I am absolutely down that rabbit hole, and it is vast. So, but there are also very interesting things. For example, like the Law of Cecines, just laws that governed the handing over of one piece of land from one owner to another at that time and place. And I loved really drilling down to go, just concretely, what happens? Not, oh, so-and-so bought such a... What happens? Who has to be there? What does it mean? And what does it look like? And how does that feel? So everything becomes very visceral. Mm-hmm. And there are so many details that I had to go off in search of so that the reader can just inconsequentially read past them and I'll just situate them there, right? What does it feel like to lie on your stomach on the Salisbury Craigs at that moment in time? And what are you seeing? And how does your damp tweed waistcoat feel? And the flask of tea, and your hand is numb as you're trying to write down the bird you just saw while you're lying next to someone with whom you're in love, but you can never have that person, you know?
Right. So all of the kind of production work that you have to do to kind of like guide the reader.
Yeah, and then there's this sexual desire while you're bird watching. And I've since actually become really fascinated to watch birds. But because Henry is a bird fancier, I was kind of chuckling going, oh God, what a nerd. And then I got so far into it. And I have such immense respect for it now. And I had to really be very careful because I thought people are rightly passionate. And this is also a piece of environmental urgency as well, songbirds especially. Mm-hmm. Or what are those tiny little carnivorous plants that bloom in moorlands? And then, you know, after I already had this moorland estate and was discovering more and more and more about the creatures and the flora and the fauna and all the wonderful transitional species, and also finding out so much about fungi and lichen and how the roots, how trees communicate with one another via the rhizomes of fungi and all of that wild, fabulous stuff, I learned that, of course, peat bogs are a vast held breath of CO2 beyond anything we ever thought before. And toward the end of the book, of course, we get there is the actual fact of there's this many tons of CO2 stored in this many acres. Can we leave it the F alone, please? Can we just also just respect everything that's happening in what looks like that worthless wetland, which is actually probably just some of the jewels in the crown of our planet?
Yeah. Well, it is a sprawling estate, a sprawling book, and a fascinating read. Anne-Marie MacDonald, thanks very much for coming and talking about Vane with me.
Thank you, Michael. Pleasure.